see what sort of questions we have this evening. Okay, when I sit for longer periods, I experience involuntary jerking and shaking. I can suppress it, but I doubt if this is a good idea. I think sometimes with, one, you have to pay attention to what is associated with that at that time, being able to recognize sometimes what the if there is some kind of involuntary jerking, shaking, what precedes that, and then you can start to pay attention to the you know, how we're setting it up, or whether, like, because it's be involuntarily, but there's certain conditions that are going to trigger or either exacerbate. So it's important to pay attention to that. And this is also where the, say, mindfulness of the body is really important right from the get-go, especially in, say, sitting for longer periods, the mind settling down. It's really important that there's a deep inner relaxation and inner ease, because sometimes that can be a trigger for the body being either jerking or shaking in some way, because there's a certain tension that's kind of deeply held. So that by really paying a lot of attention right from the get-go of relaxing, releasing, softening, being very present in the body, then it helps for the body to be very settled over a long period of time. Okay. Can you please talk about some of the changes in the new version of the morning chant, and which ones, if any, and why, resonate with you? Well, they all resonate with me because I deferred responsibility. They asked me to be part of the revision of the chanting book, and I said, you guys can do it. And so I have, I don't have any, I relinquish rights to having opinions. And generally it's okay. There's some that are really great, but I think that the inevitably when you have a you're used to one way and then it changes, it sort of for the most part I think it's quite good, all of the changes. I think it may, especially the morning chanting, I think it maybe flows a bit better than before. As I said, I didn't have the time or energy to put my two cents worth in. I had to give up opinions. So. Okay. As I consider which aspects of my life could be simplified, it occurs to me that I have two different friendships which may no longer be worth the trade-off in time or energy. After spending time with either of these friends, I tend to be more drained of my very limited energy, possibly because Neither is very self-aware, and both talk a lot. What is my obligation to an old friend who has recently come through a really hard time in her life, or to a new friend whose health and living situation are precarious? Is there a graceful way to bow out of a friendship without harming the other person? I think part of it is just that recognition that there's the investment in time and energy and isn't being balanced by support or a feeling of satisfaction or usefulness or benefit. So I think that needs to, and it isn't, I mean, the friendship shouldn't be completely calculated and tallied up. But there is a reality of that we have limited time, limited energy, and we have to use that skillfully. And there's just sometimes friendships don't have the same pull or same draw anymore. And particularly as one's practicing Dhamma, focusing on Dhamma, and it's not a value judgment or any kind of a judgment, but it just is, don't really have the time. And that's where a natural pulling back kind of tests the fabric of the friendship, in the sense that sometimes we're propping up the friendship out of a feeling of obligation, and if we pull back, then you know it doesn't really sustain itself. Not through pushing anybody away or rejecting anybody, the interests aren't sort of meshing. So that it naturally starts to fall away. Or sometimes one does just sort of step back from, and again, one didn't have to really say anything, it's just like friendships need to be nourished or nurtured, engaged in order to sustain themselves. So if one doesn't engage, and then the person kind of seeks to maintain that, then it has some sort of pull there to maintain it, and it might not be on the same sort of level of commitment as before, but it has it's quite organic. One doesn't have to really sort of say, "Well, it's just what is it?" I mean, I don't do Facebook, but you don't just what do you? It's just that you unfriend somebody. in terms of real relationships, you don't sort of, don't have to, you're unfriended now, and I don't have time, you don't do it like that, but there's a natural way that one can pull back, and there's some relationships, even if, somebody talks a lot and you end up sort of feeling, whenever you meet them, there's just like this whirlwind of energy around them. But sometimes you really love them dearly and you put up with it. So, you have to really pay attention to what's actually, say, satisfying and what energy one does have for friendships, because they do need to be supporting our own interest in living a skillful life. I'm away from a social network for almost 6 days. This is great. This just follows on to 6 days, which is quite incredible for me. Normally, I spend time by distracting myself with the social network every 10 minutes. I must check and see updates on what people are doing. Sometimes I think it's quite useless. This is a different world. However, I cannot stop using it. I'm so attached to it. And I know I'll go back to the same routine when I go back to my normal life. What would you suggest? To detach or use it wisely? Well, the thing is if you haven't really pulled back, then you don't really use it wisely. You just sort of follow a habit. And that's the problem, is that we go right back into our habits pretty quickly, so that although it is, it's great to be able to, let's say, retreat. I mean, it's really a retreat from the world, and gives us an opportunity to step back from the things that we're used to assume are normal, and realize, well, there's a whole other way of living and being feels really good. So that and just paying attention to that kind of agitation, anticipation, having to be checking in on social networking, like for and again, that's one of the things that, like, coming to Abhayagiri, anybody who comes to Abhayagiri, to live in Abhayagiri, you give up all your social networks, whatever accounts or means of social networking, you give that up, and it simplifies one's life a lot. So Facebook's the big one here in America, as well as say, like in Thailand, they use Line, so that everybody is just constantly online. That's like I get. I've had to, even during the retreat, I've been having to keep on top of keeping an eye on emails, because I'm going to Thailand next week, so they're setting up my schedule it isn't sort of, cut and paste from emails. It's screenshots from Line that I'm getting. So it's... okay. This is just another question about the sort of body swaying in meditation. So I think I answered that in that very first question. Just think body experiences. When one dies, do they carry memory of their former life into their next life? Is it possible to make amends from the former life into the next life? I think just to in terms of answering the question, I think most people don't have memories of their former lives. I think that's a really good thing. It's bad enough just remembering what you've done in this life. having to carry around, but you have a general sense in terms of this continuity of lifetimes. There'll tend to be certain patterns, and that we carry through. In the same way that in this lifetime, you can see a certain pattern going through one's lifetime. It isn't as if it's going to be all that different in former lifetimes. It's we're not that special and unique, and you know it isn't all that different. But we can also pay attention to those trends, and then the things that one recognizes or one sees that are unskillful, and sometimes, one gets intuitions or one has an image come up in the mind, and it doesn't quite relate to this life or anything, and you think, it could be something triggered deep down that's from a previous life. I mean, the downside to buying into that line of reasoning is then you start making stuff up, because again we love a story. So this recognition that on a simple principle, skillful actions have wholesome results. Unskillful actions have unwholesome results. It's just a general pattern that you can plug into your daily life and benefit from it. Okay. I've been reading the wonderful book, Abundant, Exalted, Immeasurable. That was the latest book of mine. It's a transcription of a retreat that I gave some years ago on metta and loving kindness. So would you consider leading us in a guided meditation on loving kindness at some point on this retreat, with gratitude for all your teaching? We'll see. Just read the book. It's all in the book. We'll see what comes up. Oftentimes, I don't have a big plan in terms of retreat, and oftentimes just see what feels right. And so far, it's been those themes of the gradual path. Of course, you start realizing, well, all of these things fit into the gradual path in terms of, and especially loving kindness, because it really does help to settle and there's this and building that kind of momentum. And stability of the mind that is clear and wholesome. And it's really, oftentimes, like in a meditation retreat, we want to experience peaceful states of mind. And why wouldn't one? That's what they're for. But one of the really supportive factors for the mind settling is a conscious collecting of the mind around a theme, say, of loving kindness. It brightens the mind, settles it. Okay, keeping it simple, unentangled, uncomplicated, is that an invitation to be lazy? Well, once you start real, if you comes to mind in the there's a very short, I'm not sure if it's Dhammapada or it's just a very short phrase from a sutta somewhere, but anyway the Buddha says it's just like Nibbana is the highest happiness. Nibbana paramang sukham. And it's sort of this, Nibbana is the highest happiness. And there was one time spending a rains retreat, and the senior monk had a couple of novices helping out, doing some work around his kuti, and they worked doing some cleaning up, and it was quite a long way back to their dwelling place. They ended up sort of conking out underneath his kuti, his cabin, and falling asleep. And anyway, sometime later they were quiet, and you know, okay, well, they're conked out there. And sometime later they woke up, and one of the novices, sort of this big yawn, "Oh, sleep is the highest happiness." taking a Dhamma principle and turning it into something other than Dhamma. So that simple, unentangled, uncomplicated is a way to, you know, to really help the mind free itself from the unskillful, unwholesome tendencies that create suffering. And say being lazy is not helpful in any way, shape, or form for progressing on the path to freedom from suffering. So these qualities of mind that we want to be cultivating, they all have a purpose, and that's for freedom from suffering, for really realizing the truth of the Dhamma. Okay, yeah. This morning you talked about sense, object, contact, feeling. Gave the example of the eye and object coming in contact, etc. The sixth sense is the mind, heart, correct? And the object is the heart mind. Anything? Thanks. And we can give an example. So that, well, what it is, of course, the mind is the sense, and the mind object is the, could be feeling, perception, thought, emotion. All of that is as an object of mind. It's what the mind does. So you have the mind as a sense, and then you have the content of the mind, which we have to know. So then what the mind, the activities that the mind engages in. So some of it can be quite basic in terms of, you know, the feeling, perception, and some of it can be wonderfully entangled and complicated, as in the previous question. So that thought, emotion, is all objects of mind. They're what the mind does. Okay, if a Sotapanna or a Sakadagami dies and takes birth as a human, are they born as a stream enterer or once returner respectively? Or do they return to that attainment later in life? Well, the thing is the mind stream. So that just that word Sotapanna is one who has entered the stream. Sota is stream. So it's like one has entered the stream of Dhamma, and there is no going back. So the stream enterer, once returner, when they take birth, then that's their baseline. And it doesn't mean that there's not other aspects of their being as a stream enterer. They've entered the stream, grounded in right view, that impetus toward truth and liberation is very strong, so that that's the sort of being that they are, and so that doesn't, it's not something that they that's some sort of attainment waiting for them later down the road in their life. It is, that is their sort of birthright, or that's their fundamental makeup of their being. Okay. This morning, as I was walking upstairs, my mind suddenly went bright and clear for a brief time. Was this a glimpse of Nibbana? And if so, where do I catch the express train? So there's the mind being suddenly bright and clear for a brief time. So that sense of but certainly that recognition that the mind can be bright and clear is a real motivation, because that's that sense, I mean, probably that feeling of, that's why, if so, where do I catch the express train? There's a feeling of kind of exhilaration of, oh, this is possible. This is not just some theory or something that happened to somebody who died 2,500 years ago. This is the possibility of the human mind, human heart. So, but in terms of say a glimpse of Nibbana is. That's, you have to test that over and over and over, really, to recognize, okay, is the mind really transformed, and that's what it's really going to, which then you have to pay attention to, because we get very attached to those ideas and create a sense of self around it, which is a problem, kind of ends up precluding a deeper realization. So one takes these experiences and hold them lightly, hold them skillfully, but recognizing that this you can encourage and nurture one's motivation and commitment to practice, to training, in a really skillful way through those experiences. It's very important. Okay. Gratitude for teaching us the Dhamma and for your presence in the world. Can you speak a bit about aversion and letting go? I'm dealing with the loss of my brother and the ending of a 15-year marriage. Painful memories are hard to process, and it is easier to push them away. I'd like to, quote-unquote, know and, quote-unquote, let go of them. I think one of it is just that that sense of a committing to a process of knowing and letting go, recognizing that that is a way to, own them, understand them, but also release them. And it doesn't mean that it's not painful, but this is sometimes where the willingness to acknowledge or recognize or see clearly something that is painful can be the catalyst for knowing it clearly and releasing it, or giving it permission to cease. And because sometimes we feel that it can be too overwhelming or you know, there's aversion, as mentioned, sort of aversion that the mind goes over things that were triggered that kind of painful memories, conflict. But it's important that we hold it as an object of understanding and releasing with the intention of, say, of compassion. And say, rather than picking up something that is painful and then identifying with it, having a sense of ownership of this is me and this is my painful life, and you know, because we can, and again, we can have aversion to that, or we can have disappointment to it. But it's sort of when we use something that's painful to be observing or acknowledging, then it can be a catalyst for releasing and transforming. When we relate to it with from a perspective of self, of me, of the attendant feelings of loss or disaffection, or then it keeps that process of suffering, feeds it, nourishes it, keeps it rolling. So that to, you know, one's attending to an object, but it's in two completely different ways, and it's important to be really exercising discernment and reflection. I said, where is this taking me? And paying attention. How can I hold this really skillfully so that it's transformed rather than it eats me up, which is oftentimes what happens. So those aspects of, and there's many different ways of reflecting, just in the sense of we say as human beings, we all experience loss in some way, shape, or form. We all experience change. Everybody has to experience the separation from health, and so that process of, even if everything goes completely perfectly through our life, no glitches, no hiccups, we still have to grow old. We still have to experience some sort of illness, a decreasing of our faculties, and finally death. And it's just as a part of the human condition. So, and that's not, and you say that's not depressing, or it's not. It's just ordinary, and you know, that being able to see it in that light as an opportunity for understanding, and then the mind is able to release and let go. And we're using it as a catalyst. But I think one is of course the investigation, applying discernment, but the other is that lifting up of compassion for oneself and for others. I believe this to be a silent meditation retreat. Please reiterate that to my thinking mind. It's not listening. I think that is, and with gratitude, it's all good. but I think that's important. Is sometimes we just want to have a break from this sort of ceaseless chatter. And we just want to be silent. We just like you look at your mind. It's like, will you shut up already? but that in itself, of course, that attitude is, have you ever tried that with a little child? It's just, it really doesn't work. Somebody else. And so there's no reason why it's going to work with us. And we put a lot of effort into trying to not think, or we approach it from if I didn't think, I'd be peaceful, it's a logical kind of equation, you know. I think, therefore I suffer. And if I didn't think, then I wouldn't suffer. And so you try to stop thinking. But you know, the reality is you can't just through a force of will stop the mind from thinking. And two, even if you were able to just really stop thinking through a force of will or, you know, some sort of, you know, practice or really kind of crushing mind with mind, it really would be, you'd still be suffering. And it's just really, there's a tightness and tenseness there that comes back to bite you. So that learning how to think skillfully, learning how to direct attention, it's like descriptions of the meditative process, the first jhana, which is quite a refined state of mind, has directed thought and evaluation. It's just the mind is thinking. You're lifting up skillful thought processes that help the mind to gather its energy around something that is settling, uplifting, unifying, energizing in a settled way, and then the mind is ready to the busyness is ready to fall away, and that's kind of what happens. So that we have to learn how to use the mind skillfully, use the thinking processes, or just like in the Eightfold Path, that right thoughts of renunciation, thoughts of relinquishment, thoughts of loving kindness, thoughts of compassion. Those are wholesome thought processes, trains of thought that help the mind settle and uplift it. It's sort of like as we become more skilled in the thought processes that nurture these qualities of that which is wholesome, skillful, that is kusala, then there's a well-being that settles, and it's deeply settling. And it's only when we actually feel comfortable and there's a strong degree of well-being and certain happiness or contentment that we're ready to drop the thought processes or just let them fall away, because they start to appear coarse in comparison to what we're experiencing. So that just learning how to direct our thought, and so that even if we're you know, still thinking. It's trying to channel into what is skillful, and it'll start to become quiet on its own. Okay, last question. Could you please talk a bit about using the sound of silence, not a sound, as a meditation object? I can talk about lots of things, but I haven't really. I have used the sound of silence a little bit, but I'm not that experienced with it. It never didn't really resonate with me. Ajahn Sumedho was sort of the primary person in our community who used it. Ajahn Amar, of course, who spent a lot of time with Ajahn Sumedho. Has used it a lot, so that's a way of prefacing what I say might not have a whole lot of credence behind it. But using the sound of silence, I mean, one of the things, or certainly in my own experience of just experimenting with it, our mind, the habit of the mind is to go to the content of the mind, and it busies itself with the content, and busies itself with the thoughts, it busies itself with the emotion or the ideas or the opinions or the chatter. And within that, there's always a stillness there. And just that's the nature of the mind, is that the mind is still, it's clear, it's silent. And we fill up that silence because it's sort of like compulsively checking your Facebook or line. It's just out of habit. So that out of habit, we keep going to our thoughts, and the thoughts gain momentum, and moods, and the ideas, and they keep popping up in the mind, and we keep going to them. So that lifting up this, a sound of silence, which is kind of more like a backdrop behind those processes, that movement, you realize, oh, if I pay attention to this, it's there. That gains momentum. And that's a really helpful insight. And it's a really helpful tool. Because you realize, well, we always have that with us. And the way that Ajahn Sumedho speaks of it, of just it's like there's always a ringing sound, or something that is a part of the backdrop of the mind, and you can, and it's there all the time. You can just tune into that, and rather than getting caught in the different thought processes, and it helps to highlight the thought processes in terms of framing our thought processes in a different way. You've got a backdrop of silence. It's like, you know, you look up into the sky, and the mind is immediately looks for an object. You don't look for the space, do you? You don't look at that sort of incredible expanse of blue that the mind starts looking for a plane fly, a cloud, or whatever. It's just what our mind is conditioned to do. So that by consciously looking at the expanse of sky, or I'm saying the night. We don't look at the just that what holds the stars. And we look at the stars. We try to figure out a constellation. That's what the mind does. We look at the moon. It's an object. So we're very object oriented. So to counter that with looking at what holds it, what's around it. The same. So we're sitting here in this meditation hall, and somebody asks, what's here? And you say, there's all these people and there's some monks and then there's some pews and there's stations of the cross and there's an altar up in front. And that actually comprises a very small portion of what's here. What's here mostly is space. And the mind doesn't go to it first thing. So that sound of silence is giving the mind something other than its trains of thought, its obsessive moods, and just giving it something to dissolve into. And that's really skillful, that's really helpful, and very settling. So that picking up that as a, say, as a theme of meditation, just letting the mind rest in something that's not so object-oriented, not so concrete and solid, and just letting it be spacious. It's a wonderful way to experiment with the mind. Okay, that was the last question.